For people, the encounter with the other is not always an encounter with the obviously superhuman, not always an encounter with a spirit or with a god. That encounter may also take the form, for example, of suspecting somebody of witchcraft, in which case there are people around who've got some superhuman power but are still basically human. This encounter with the other side also affects relations between members of the same community without any reference to witchcraft. There are contexts, for example, in which men find women superhuman. There are contexts in which men play the part of the superhumans. And in order to build up a total model of what people are doing, one has to take into consideration the fact that the majority of people have always lived in quite small communities, and that those small communities have always been divided for practical purposes into three major subdivisions: the women, the men, and the children. Now, there is a huge complication here which is tied up with something I've referred to earlier in the series. The process of looking at the world systematically in terms of human diversity has been a recent development, largely in Western Europe. And those areas strongly affected by Western Europe, areas colonized by West Europeans, or indeed East Europeans, Russians, sucked in to the orbit of Western European culture. Now, the result of this, I've already emphasized in terms of the Enlightenment. The Enlightenment has had all sorts of malign effects upon anthropology. And in the same way, of course, the way in which the Industrial Revolution has affected the social behavior of West Europeans and those affected by them has also been very peculiar. There is a tendency, for example, for anthropologists to treat it as quite normal that a man, a woman, and their 2.54 children or whatever should live in a box in a suburb. This is not normal, and for that reason, of course, the sort of domestic ideals which are represented, say, on American television are not the best place to start when you're trying to look at human normality. Human normality is a small group of people, 50 to 100, 150 people, living together in a community somewhere, reliant upon each other in all sorts of ways, and not broken up tidily into little earning subgroupings of the kind that one would find in a Midwestern American suburb. So that it may well be that the future is the American suburb. There are all sorts of reasons for doubting that. But whatever the future may be, it is certainly not the human past. Recorded history, and doubtless the 4 million years or whatever it is of prehistory, are taken up very largely with small groups of people living in communities. Now, it's against that kind of backdrop that it's very significant that one should appreciate the differences between children, women, and men. One of the features that is very obvious when one looks, for example, at sub-Saharan African societies, or indeed at Amazonian societies in South America, peoples in the Pacific Islands, is that these communities are made up of people in which the women have a very distinctive way of life and spend much of their time with other women. The men have an equally distinctive way of life and spend most of their time with other men, and the children do not spend much of their time with adults at all. The Victorians, we are told, claimed that children should be seen but not heard. The normal view since human beings began seems to have been that children should neither be seen nor heard because they're not there. Children normally, in most societies, live their lives well apart from adults, and the leadership of children is provided by children, and a good deal of the education, if one can use so formalistic a word, of children is also provided by older children. Children learn from children, and they learn to be adults by taking responsibility in the world of children. Now, it is probably safe to say that when adults in human societies all over the world look at children, they do not associate those children very closely with superhuman power or with the borderland where superhuman power merges into the world of the human, a borderland which I've emphasized a good deal in these lectures. On the other hand, when children look at adults, male or female, what they see immediately is authority. And that authority, for most children, merges upwards through the great chain of being, by way of the ancestral dead, dead members of our own community, through the world of various divine beings, superhuman beings of various sorts, to the ultimate authority of God Almighty. For the children, the adults can, on occasion, appear to be endued with a certain amount of superhuman authority. After all, no authority is worth much unless it does have some sort of superhuman backing. When we look at the anthropological literature, it has been claimed by feminist writers in recent decades that this literature is seriously deficient in its information about women. I would need to be convinced of that, because I'm not convinced that if you look back over the anthropological literature of the last 100 years, you will necessarily find it to be severely deficient in information about women. But one thing is absolutely certain: it is seriously deficient in information about children. The people whose sub-community in any community tends to be underrepresented in most, not all, but most of the anthropological literature, that sub-community is children. It is children that we do not hear enough about, rather than women. When we look at the overall pattern of the way human beings within a community tend to look at each other, what we find is that the superhuman is in fact present within the human community. Not only, as I say, in the context of people accusing other people of witchcraft, though it certainly is assumed to be present there, but even in relations between the members of a single household. I've begun the ball rolling by pointing out that children tend to look at adults as having all sorts of superhuman authority, which they certainly don't have themselves. And it's probably safe to say, and again I would invite you to test what I'm saying for yourselves, it's probably true to say that children everywhere tend to idealize adults. They tend to see them in much more superhuman, much more divine terms than it is realistic to do. Children tend to see adults, not just parents, but all adults, in terms of a much finer set of ideals and attainments than is probably realistic when you look at those people from the outside. However, when one looks at the relations between the sexes and between older people and younger people within human communities, what one finds repeatedly is that an awful lot of the discussion very quickly begins to gravitate towards women. The position of women, the peculiar place of women in human communities, eventually tends to hog the limelight in discussions of this kind, and I'll have to repeat all sorts of varied observations about this aspect of it as we go through the session today. But before we go any further, let's look at certain key aspects of relations between the sexes when it comes to interplay with the superhuman powers. Is it possible to make any general observations about what is happening? And it does seem that there are some observations that we can make on a really quite sweeping stage. To begin with, I suppose we ought to get really basic and ask, well, what is it that women everywhere do? What is it that men everywhere do? This has been something which has exercised some feminist writers a great deal, and feminist writers very often are keen to say that there isn't actually anything very definite that separates men from women. On the whole, it's probably true to say that there are some quite definite activities that separate men from women. Very little of the hunting of large animals is done by women in the records that we have of human societies. Granted, of course, that most of the human story is prehistory and we don't have any records, it is doubtful how much hunting was done by men or women, say 40,000 years BP, or indeed 2 million years BP. But it is a probable guess that most of the hunting that involves a great deal of running about and long searches over large areas of territory has always been done by men. The fighting, most of it, has been done by men. Indeed, relations with other people, foreigners, people you can't trust, is usually done by men. This is something which is difficult to refute from the historical period. And another feature which one can hardly help noticing is that a great deal of the ritual is performed by men. Men are very prominent when it comes to performing rituals, and although women are not absent from rituals, they have ritual performances. Indeed, in some contexts, women perform all the rituals of a certain type. Basically, there is an obvious reliance upon men for the performing of rituals. It's very conspicuous, for example, that so far no woman has ever been Bishop of Rome. No woman has yet been Archbishop of Canterbury. This is a particular Christian context, rather a restricted one, but in fact, if you throw the net wider, you find a similar tendency for ritual roles to be monopolised by men and women to be not present. Let's look, for example, in the backdrop of the Christian Church at the high priesthood in Jerusalem, the model from which a great deal of Christian ritual activity is taken. How many women in the records have ever been high priests in Jerusalem? There aren't any priests, there are any high priests in Jerusalem now, but over the period of time when there were, how many women took the role? According to the records, none. And similarly, of course, if one looks at priesthood in India or in China or in Japan, what one finds again and again, that if we look at the records, there is a marked shortage of women in the process of ritual performance. Having said this, without going too much further, what are the things which are associated with women? Well, one thing which is quite importantly associated with women is gathering. It seems very likely that if we knew a bit more about prehistoric hunting and gathering societies, we would discover that the reason why human beings have survived for as many million years as they apparently have is basically because women, over long periods of time, gathered most of the field, and there is a strong theory, gathered most of the food in the field of food, but at the same time, it is fairly clear that the men's contribution, which may have been highly valued because it came from hunting, has really not been enough most of the time to keep people alive. We are here, if you like, because of women. And that does seem to be difficult to refute, though, of course, we're dealing with the past, with the historic times, yes, but in fact mostly with prehistoric times and with societies without writing. At the same time, of course, there is a strong theory which can't be either rebutted or convincingly established that farming, when it began, the cultivation of crops, was started by women as a development out of their gathering activities. Highly plausible, but not something we can refute. However, when we look at activities like fighting, for example, fighting alien groups, there is indeed evidence that women have done some of this. There has been fighting done by women. There have been women who've certainly taken part in large animal hunting on the plains of North America in the mid-19th century. Those women who wanted to were certainly allowed to hunt bison with the male hunters. And similarly with gathering, there is abundant evidence that men have done some gathering, and indeed that men have played a substantial part in farming once that farming began, even if it was, as some theorists claim, begun by women as a development from gathering. But in the whole set of activities in which human beings take any part whatever, there are some features which are not open to a certain amount of intersexual borrowing. In one particular respect, all the activities have been concentrated in the hands of women. Hands is perhaps not quite the right word, but in the realm of childbirth, women have a monopoly which dominates human experience. And as I shall go on to say during this particular lecture, there's good evidence that dominates is the right word. Childbirth is a dominating fact in human beings' lives, and it is something which not only dominates activity in the sense that it is quintessential to human continuity, but it is also, it seems, dominating in the effect it has upon men's attitudes towards women. Now, there are a few complications here which I ought to deal with rather briefly, because in parts of New Guinea, it is claimed that men have on occasion become pregnant. The full extent of these stories are not something which I need to go into now, but it is a widespread belief among New Guinea men that men can be pregnant. If we ask the further question, well, how many of these men have actually gone on to give birth? The answer seems to be that none of them have, because when men do become pregnant in New Guinea societies, they are apparently always killed by the other men. So, as far as we know, however pregnant men in these places may have become, they have never actually got to the point of parturition, because they're always killed at some stage during pregnancy. The full significance of that may become a little clearer later as we go on. There are people who claim, certainly, and this again is relevant to what I shall have to say later, that the process of men becoming pregnant would seem to fit in very well with the attitudes of New Guinea men, because New Guinea men do seem to be very jealous of women becoming pregnant and giving birth to babies, and you might feel that in this kind of context men would be extremely pleased if other men became pregnant and gave birth, but apparently not, because they kill, so they say, any men who do. So perhaps there's inconsistency here, but then perhaps one of the things we have to get used to when dealing with people is that they are very inconsistent. Let's come back to the mainstream in African, European or monsoon Asian societies. You won't actually find many men claiming that men have become pregnant or are likely to become pregnant. And this means that there is a widespread acceptance in most parts of the world that childbirth is a very fine example of a monopoly activity. Women, not men, not children, engage in childbirth. Childbirth is something which is very distinctively female, and indeed in many societies you will find that there are no men who have ever actually seen a baby born. Childbirth is so distinctively female that no men ever get near a woman when she is giving birth. Now, this perhaps introduces us to the key clue in the discussion of men, women, children, and the superhuman. Even without going into specific examples, it is very clear that there is something very strange about childbirth. It's very peculiar. It is something set apart. No attempt, perhaps, by anybody to turn childbirth into something mundane like sleeping or eating will really work. Childbirth isn't mundane. It is very strange. It has the quality of the miraculous about it. Again, I want to cut the discussion short. I don't want to use huge numbers of examples. I don't want to go on at great length. If there is anything that I'm saying which you find weird, wonderful, or frankly incredible, then the best thing to do is to check the literature and see what substance there is on what I'm saying. But I'm prepared to stick my neck out here and saying that childbirth is something quite different from anything else that human beings do, and that it is a faculty which sets women apart both from men and from children, and which is a dominating emotional force not only in the way human societies work, but also in the way in which the members of human communities look at each other and see themselves in terms of the frontiers between the human and the superhuman. To put it very crudely, in childbirth, women join the superhuman powers. In childbirth, women do not belong to human societies at all. They are part of cosmic processes, akin in one direction to, say, witchcraft, and akin in others to possession by the superhuman powers. I'll say a bit more about that in a moment, but it is relevant to something which I've talked about already, and that is that women are usually not involved in the hunting of big game animals. Women are not usually engaged in the processes involved with fighting alien peoples, or if you look, to put it crudely, women don't play much part in war. And as I've also pointed out, women don't play much part in major rituals. Some people will claim that the reason for that is that it's inconvenient. Women are always tied up with looking after the children. They're frequently pregnant. It's inconvenient to go fighting or to go hunting or to take part in major rituals. But this won't work, of course, because after all, some women, some of the time, certainly are free to take part in fighting. There's been a great deal of fighting in aggregate done by women through the historic period. And although much more of it has been done by men, it's quite wrong to say that there is an absolute embargo on women fighting. There isn't. Zulu in the last century had entire women regiments. In the same period, the Fon people in the kingdom of Dahomey on the west coast of Africa also had women regiments. Never as many women in the regiments as men, but women in the regiments. Much more recently, in this century, after the formation of the State of Israel in 1948, women were not only drafted into the army as part of national service, but some women combat units actually went into battle. One of the curious features about Israel's recent experience is that Israel's military intelligence discovered that their opponents, whoever they were, the various people who had to fight these female combat units, were absolutely terrified of them. The reason why the Israeli armed forces gave up women combat units was not because they were ineffective. Indeed, the women in these units were apparently extremely good at it. They were given up as a part of a conciliatory measure by the Israeli state to improve their relations with their neighbours, which of course is what it's all about. And the abandonment of female combat units was precisely because they were too effective, too terrifying, and indeed apparently some of the opponents whom these combat units faced were terrified that if they were killed by a woman they would never enter paradise. In this case, of course, what we're dealing with, therefore, is not the notion of the feebleness of women. It is not the feebleness of women that prevents them from going to war, or which prevents them from hunting, or which doubtless prevents them from becoming Archbishop of Canterbury. What it is something quite alternative. It is their power which is terrifying, not their feebleness. And the key to the whole process seems to be that the keeping of women out of ritual, out of war, and out of certain kinds of heavy hunting is precisely that they are so radiant with cosmic power, the cosmic power associated with childbirth and with menstruation, that they are kept away because they are likely to juggle the forces. The reason why men are better as archbishops than women are, apparently, is because basically men are fairly, in cosmic terms, cool, and they don't have such a vibrating impact upon the ritual which is being performed as a woman would. The issue here is therefore quite a complicated one, because in a lot of human societies, in a lot of contexts, men like to emphasize the fact that women are rather feeble. All the anthropological evidence indicates quite clearly that it is women who are precisely not feeble. Women are dangerously powerful. And this dangerous power apparently absolutely dominates the human social relations within communities between children, men, and women. Children and men never have the basic power that women do have. Let's examine this a little further, because the evidence is rather good. On the one hand, one can see that there is something slightly uncanny about childbirth, slightly uncanny to say the least. Childbirth involves the production of a human individual, sometimes indeed two human individuals, where formerly there were none at all. Childbirth has got something of the quality of a miracle. To start off with, there's just this woman. Then the woman becomes pregnant. Later on, she gives birth, let us say in this case to twins, and you have two people in addition to the original one, so one becomes three. You may say, if you try and be sort of down to earth about this, it can all be explained. But even the process of explaining it has got a rather weird character. Desperate attempts by sort of modern European physiologists to tell you what happens when a woman becomes pregnant and gives birth to twins. Actually, the more carefully you listen to them, the less like everyday life and the more like miracle they sound. The more you have to do with childbirth, the more inclined you are to believe that probably it is basically a miracle. And therefore, of course, since men don't have much part in this miracle, the impression is that women must be much closer to the superhuman world than are men. In this context, women aren't really human. When women are pregnant and when they're giving birth, they really enter the world of the superhumans. They become spirit-like. The other aspect of women, which from men's point of view rather than from women's is very peculiar, is of course menstruation. Menstruation is something which clearly has an extraordinary impact on men across the world. And it is something which is indeed, by its very nature, somewhat weird. When one looks at menstruation carefully, rather than just sort of brushing it aside as one of those things which are just part of human life, one can brush childbirth aside in much the same way. But if we look carefully at menstruation, clearly it is a very, very strange occurrence. On the whole, in human life, the shedding of blood is associated with injury, it's associated with wounding, it's associated with debility, and indeed, in many contexts, it's actually associated with death. If men lose a great deal of blood, they usually die. Certainly, they take a long time to recover. Women, once they reach adulthood, get rid of quite substantial quantities of blood every month, without apparently suffering any harm. Indeed, to such an extent that in New Guinea, men claim that menstruation is terribly good for women. It improves their health, to such an extent, indeed, that the men take considerable efforts to menstruate themselves. They actually induce quasi-menstruation to improve their own health. Menstruation then may not be quite as dramatic as childbirth, but from a narrowly male point of view, or from the point of view of children who don't know what menstruation is and are learning about it for the first time, menstruation is a pretty uncanny activity. Here are these women. They lose in a lifetime really quite quantities of blood that most men would prefer not to think about. And at the same time, they don't appear to suffer any harm, and in fact appear to be extremely robust. The notion that women are feeble is particularly associated, I ought to say, with upper classes. What you'll find in societies like those of New Guinea, where there are no upper classes, what you find in many African local communities is a conviction among men that women are pretty tough and that they can engage in some prolonged hard work without doing themselves any harm. And yet at the same time, these amazing creatures emit large quantities of blood. Okay, it's not just blood, but the point is, blood is a very powerful substance. It's very powerful in human symbolism. And when one looks at menstrual discharge, the thing that is most striking about it is the bloody aspect. The fact that there is blood involved is very obvious from the colour, and it is this, of course, which has the emotional impact which makes menstruation so important in human values. The fact that the blood lost in menstrual discharge each month is not perhaps quite as much as it looks doesn't alter the fact that it looks frightfully much, and the overall impact is very strong. Menstruation is not a subject that most men find particularly comfortable. It is not something which most of them wish to talk about, and it's not just in New Guinea or in some other parts of the world that menstruation is a big issue. It is really one of the more important symbolic aspects of human life overall. A few comments on this. Let's get back to New Guinea. New Guinea seems to be assuming considerable importance in this discussion, and there's good reason why it should, because in the first place, New Guinea is pretty certainly the best documented area ethnologically in the world for its size. We know an extraordinary amount about New Guinea. It's a wonderful place. It's pretty certain there are places up in the western highlands of New Guinea which have not yet been visited by Europeans, let alone documented by them. But nevertheless, even without those, the overall picture of New Guinea that has been built up over the last 100 years is very detailed indeed, and this alone makes it a very significant place in the anthropological literature. In particular, the highlands of the interior, which were only discovered by the first Europeans, as far as we know, in the 1930s, have been documented repeatedly and assiduously ever since. So over a period of decades in this century just gone, what has happened is that the picture built up of the peoples of Highland New Guinea has been very, very refined. We have a very good knowledge of them. But this is not the main reason for bringing them into the discussion here. The reason why New Guinea men are so interesting in this particular aspect of the course is because they do have some very distinctive views towards women, and especially in the Central Highlands. I've mentioned already the fact that you will find in some New Guinea societies the view that men can become pregnant. This is a very distinctive part of New Guinea culture, which is not readily paralleled in other parts of the Pacific Islands, let alone in other parts of the world outside Oceania. And this is not their only feature, because in the highlands in particular, though also in other parts of New Guinea, you will find to a very accentuated degree the fear of menstrual blood and the awe of women as childbearing creatures, which we can find, it seems to me, everywhere. But because in Highland New Guinea they're so dramatic, they're so accentuated, this is obviously a good place to start when looking at them. And one feature of Highland New Guinea men, which I've briefly alluded to up to now, but which I'm now going to deal with in slightly more detail, is this whole question of men menstruating. I've already pointed out that lots of New Guinea men will tell you that menstruating is terribly good for women. That I'm not sure that New Guinea women are necessarily quite so emphatic about this, and I'm not sure that most European women would go on about the wonders of menstruation at great length either. But if you listen to New Guinea men, you will hear that menstruation is a terribly good thing and that it does powers of good for women's health, to such an extent that large numbers of New Guinea men go to great lengths to rub rough fibrous substances up the urethra of their penis in order to induce genital bleeding in that area, and they engage also in similar practices, making their noses bleed. Noses in New Guinea, as in many other parts of the world, being symbolic penises. This is quite familiar to you probably in human contexts well outside New Guinea. You probably know the kind of folklore in European societies that you can tell the length of a man's penis by looking at the length of his nose, or that you can tell the size of the vaginal aperture of a woman you meet by looking at the size of her mouth. I'm not sure anyone has ever actually carried out any extensive tests on whether this folklore is reliable, but the folklore is certainly there, and I only mention it because it just goes to show that some penis-nose symbolism is found in Europe, just as it's found in New Guinea. The importance from our point of view, of course, is the trouble that initiated New Guinea men go to make themselves bleed. And apparently this bleeding is quite specifically quasi-menstrual. They're doing it because they feel it's good for them, and it's good for them because it's clear that menstruation is terribly good for women. It's easy to go on about this at tedious length, and I won't do it. But it's worth mentioning before I go any further, and without leaving Oceania, that when the Europeans arrived in Australia, they found that the vast majority of the societies there engaged in circumcision for the men, and the vast majority of the circumcising societies also engaged in a practice which is usually technically known as sub-incision. Sub-incision is the practice whereby, at initiation, men are cut along the bottom of the penis to the depth of the urethra. That is, the whole penis on the underside is slit open and then allowed to heal. Sub-incision strikes most Europeans as a pretty drastic practice, and it's also a fairly problematic one. Why do they do it? They made the more difficult because, like as with so many customs, the local people do not have a vast body of interpretation. Many anthropologists will tell you of the frustration that they encounter when they try and get people to account for their own customs. They receive answers of the kind, "Yes, we always do this. Our ancestors did it long ago. It is a good thing to do." This is a practice which has come to us from past times. All sorts of really helpful comments of that kind, which don't really tell you anything about why people started doing it in the first place. And sub-incision is pretty certainly one of the most baffling of human practices. There's no doubt it's important. Anything to do with cutting the genitals, whether they be male or female, is always important. But what exactly is the precise significance of it? After all, you can get blood from the penis without slitting it to that drastic extent. After all, New Guinea men, just to the north of Australia, are able to obtain some blood from the penis or from the nose without going to the drastic lengths of sub-incision. I don't want to get too carried away on this aspect of the subject, but it is important to point out that they must be doing it for reasons which are rooted deeply in the Australian cultural past, as must indeed the practice of circumcision itself. And one possible reason for their doing it simulate menstruation, as in parts of New Guinea. There's a particularly strengthening aspect of that in terms of Australian practices, because there's good evidence that men who have already been subincised and the wound has healed very often recut themselves or have themselves recut at one end or other of the slit at the bottom of the penis in order to induce bleeding again. And this does remind one rather of the nose bleeding and penis bleeding practices of parts of New Guinea, which are quite explicitly linked by some local male commentators to a quasi-menstruation. We are sort of menstruating. And it's quite likely that this much more drastic practice in Australia was originally some kind of male menstrual simulation. I won't go on about this, but it is important to realise just how dramatic an effect upon men, if not upon women, menstruation has. Without trying to put too much emphasis upon Oceania, upon the peoples of Australia and of New Guinea, I can introduce some observations that I've made myself over the years in England. There are people in England who would try and distance English men from the primitive savages of the Pacific Islands or the primitive savages of Australia. I am not inclined to distance them in that way, certainly not in the context of menstruation, because I noticed at a very early age at school the sort of very shuddery responses of my contemporaries to menstruation, and over the years I've noticed what a very, very minor part menstruation plays in English male conversation. If you consider the amount of time that women spend referring to menstruation, the differences of subculture in England between men and women is very startling. And one piece of evidence that I find very striking, it's not absolutely exhaustive, but it is interesting, is if you look at so-called pornographic material. I'm not sure what pornography is, and pornographic is a word I use always in inverted commas, but if you look at sexual magazines, if you look at sexual films and sexual videos, you will realize that these produce vast acreages of imagery showing naked human female bodies. There are vast expanses of bottoms, vast expanses of breasts, hectares of pubic hair, and so on. And I haven't ever had the time, or indeed the inclination, to carry out a really intensive study of sexual videos, of sexual films, sexual magazines. It's not uninteresting, but after a bit, what I find, there's a certain sameness about it all. But the thing which really strikes me between the eyes about it, which bowls me over backwards because of my interest in the genital cutting practices of various peoples, including those of New Guinea and of Australia, is the fact that in everything that I have ever encountered, literally everything that I've ever encountered, in the field of erotic imagery, is totally devoid of even a speck of menstrual discharge. There is not a trace of menstrual blood in the fantasy literature of the erotic aspects of women's bodies. When you consider the part of menstrual blood in a woman's life, you know, if you're a normal, healthy English woman, menstrual blood is going to play a rather practical and important part in years of your life. You have to do something about it in practical terms. And yet in the imagery of English men, there is nothing. Some of you may have heard of a commercial firm in California called Tasteless Video. And Tasteless Video have concentrated on producing videos of the disgusting. In their videos, men copulate with very fat women, they copulate with pregnant women, they copulate with lactating women, they copulate with very old women. When, however, Tasteless Video, true to their principles, turned to men copulating with menstruating women, of course they've got to do it, in terms of what they're trying to do, they found that the sails were totally dead. Men apparently do not wish to see men copulating with menstruating women. Predictable, but very interesting that that was their commercial discovery. So that when we look at the whole question of where men and women fit into the world of the superhuman, you may feel that I've been going on at rather tedious length about childbirth and about menstrual discharge, but I do feel that this is actually justifiable. Men's views of women, not just in Highland New Guinea, not just in the central desert of Australia, but in Surbiton and in Basingstoke and even in Crewe, are actually coloured to a huge extent by these extraordinary and indeed arguably superhuman features of the way the human female body works. Menstrual discharge and childbirth really do have an enormous effect upon the way in which men look at women all over the world. And in this sense, of course, one could argue that certainly there cannot be any sexual equality, because when one looks at the human world, what one sees is essentially a world in which, of course, men and women cannot possibly be equal, because unless men catch up on women by menstruating and giving birth to babies, they will never, in any context whatever, be equal to them. In that sense, sexual equality is a fantasy. Now, what about the other features which the feminists might like to pay more attention to? What about the fact that there hasn't been a female prime minister in most countries, or the fact that there aren't many female sovereigns? There are, of course, clearly some. And what about the fact that there hasn't been a female pope or a female Archbishop of Canterbury? Well, yes, this may all be very true, but in this context, in the light of what I have said, what I'm pointing out, of course, is that basically the reason why women don't become popes or archbishops of Canterbury is not really to do with the fact that they are being discriminated against on the grounds of being inadequate. If anything, they're being discriminated against on the grounds of being over-adequate. I mean, the problem with women is that fundamentally to go to bed with a woman is more or less like going to bed with a nuclear reactor. It's a process which involves so much power emanating from the female side, not from the male, that the reason why one falls back upon these rather cool male people to do Archbishop of Canterbury sorts of jobs is simply because for the women to do it is unsuitable. If you like, one way of looking at it is that women are so spiritual already, they're so firmly plugged in to the cosmic system, that they are either not needed in the priesthood, or indeed they might even spoil the goods in the process. If a woman is this powerful, should she really be handing out the wafers and the wine at the Eucharist? The process, however, is clearly very ambiguous. I don't want to end this discussion giving you the impression that within a human community, man, it's really all about menstruation and childbirth. There is a bit more to it than that. The process by which, for example, men monopolize most ritual roles, and they do, not just in the Church of England, is connected with a whole set of really quite ill-defined relations between the sexes. When you actually look at the overall picture of being male and female, you're noticing, incidentally, that children aren't getting much of a look in here, which is a point I've made already. When we look at the relations between male and female in human communities, we also have to look at those occasions when the men dress up in masks and in raffia robes and come galumphing in from the forest claiming that they are spirits. This is something which is very familiar in a lot of the tropical world. I mean, whether it be the men playing on the long wooden musical instruments in the highlands of New Guinea and claiming that these sounds are the spirits, or the men doing much the same sort of thing among the Mbuti pygmies in the wet forests of Central Africa, or the men playing upon extremely similar instruments. Just how these similar instruments turn up in so many different parts of the world, I'm not at all clear, but they do. And they make the same sort of sounds, and those sounds, say the men, are the sounds of the spirits, whether it be in Highland New Guinea, whether it be in Central Africa, whether it be in Amazonia. There are always these men playing on these wooden flutes and claiming that they are the sounds of the spirits. I use the word flutes, they're not really flutes, the word is sometimes used, but they are woodwind instruments of some sort. In the same way, of course, across great swathes of West Africa, men put on these elaborate masks and the sort of raffia dress that goes with them, and they come pounding into the villages, and you've doubtless, many of you, seen film and video of this, and they are, quote, quote, the spirits. The women know perfectly well that they are the men dressed up in the robes and with the suitable, you know, raffia trappings that one expects with this kind of thing, but they nevertheless play the game, and they go ahead as if they were the duly cowed human congregation who have been visited from the forest by the spirits, the men playing the part. Now, in this sort of context, which one knows only too well from all sorts of parts of the world, it is quite clear that it is the men who are being associated with the superhuman powers and not the women. There are wonderful examples of this in Amazonia, where the men go off in the forest and prepare themselves to play the part of the spirits, and then come and invade the village where the women and the children have shut themselves in the houses. And the men, playing the part of the invasive spirits from the wild places, come in and they try and break in to the houses, and the women and the children beat them off from inside the houses, and eventually the men, playing the parts of the spirits, withdraw. One of the major spirit forces in these kind of contexts is the great anteater. The great anteater comes in from the forest and tries to break into the houses, and the women and the children beat the great anteater off. Now, in this context, it's quite clear that what I've been saying about the women in the context of childbirth, in the context of menstruation, has to be radically revised. In this context, it is the women who are, as it were, leading the children in defending the settlement against spirit forces. Women here, far from being superhuman, are preeminently human. The women and the children play the human congregation. That's exactly what they're doing. It is the men who are spirit-like, the men who are linked through the superhuman world. Clearly, if we want to enter into the meta-psychology of all this, many people will be tempted to say, aha, that is because the men suffer from unbearable inferiority feelings towards the women because they don't menstruate and they don't give birth to babies, so they've got to go off into the forest and pretend they're spirits. Now, I don't want to get involved in that one. It gets a bit intense at this point. And being men, women and children is difficult enough as it is without getting involved in too much hyper-psychology. But the point is, what I want to say here is that women are not always playing the cosmic role in human communities. Sometimes they are playing the preeminently adult human role, as they clearly are in Amazonia when they defy the men spirit invaders and drive them back to the forest. Here the women are the pillars of the community, which of course is a role they are very used to playing. When you consider that most of the domestic cookery throughout history and probably throughout prehistory has been carried out by the women, it is quite clear that it is women who, rather than men, who keep the home fires burning, that women are the backbone in a very physical sense of the community. And that not only do they bring in most of the food throughout most of prehistory, and it's pretty certain that they have, but they also do most of the cooking of it. And therefore, of course, it is highly appropriate that the women should play the role of the defenders in Amazonia, because they have qualified as human beings long ago in this process. What I'm saying, therefore, is not that in some absolute sense men are more spiritual than women, or, quote, quote, women are more spiritual than men. What I'm saying is that if you actually look at the evidence that we have in front of us, sometimes men are more spiritual than women, and in other contexts, the women are more spiritual than the men. At the end of the day, perhaps most people in most societies are too worried about maintaining some kind of balanced modus vivendi to really want to put too much emphasis upon something as embarrassing as menstrual discharge or childbirth, because it might upset the daily apple cart, where you actually have to keep things going along in a fairly basic sort of way. So that what I'm really saying this week is not to draw your attention particularly to childbirth and to menstruation, but to say that one can see that even within strictly human communities, and they are supposed to be strictly human, you can see the power of the superhuman creeping in at every point, whether it be the men invading from the forest and being spirits, whether it be the sounds of the woodwind instruments, whether it be the women going off to the birth huts or the menstruation huts away from the main living area. Whatever is happening, there is a sense in which the superhuman cannot be kept out, even of the mundane human world. I mention birth huts and menstruation huts briefly, I don't want to elaborate them. It's worth giving you a striking example of the way in which childbirth is kept apart from the ordinary human world. When the Europeans arrived in the Solomon Islands, an area I've already brought into this series, and reached the island of Mala, they found off the north end of Mala there were people living in small coral islets, the Lie Islands, and they discovered there that when a woman goes into labour, what she had to do in those days was she actually had to pole herself away from the islets where the people lived to artificial islands where the birth huts were constructed, and it was only after she'd given birth on her own that the other women went out to help her. The men never went anywhere near them, of course. And this is one of the most extreme examples of birth segregation which has ever been recorded, but of course it makes the point. I mean, childbirth really is something which is not part of the ordinary run of things. Now, there's a great deal more I could say about this. Indeed, I could become very tedious indeed on this subject, and I'm going to restrain myself and stop at this point. But what I need to do at this stage is to draw your attention away from ritual and ritual specialists, and away from the metaphysical framework itself in which childbirth and menstruation belong. And I want to draw your attention to a very particular part of people's relations with the superhuman world, and that is the telling of stories, the narrative face of ritual and belief. And next week I want to turn to a sequence of lectures on the subject of myths.